Chapter 16. Helplessly, Margaret's blush had fixed itself on her throbbing forehead. She remained standing, while her strange visitor continued to gaze at her with a perturbation in which the consciousness of indiscretion had evidently as yet no part. "I simply don't see," she repeated. Suddenly she sprang up, and advancing to Margaret, laid an inspired hand on her arm. But, my dear woman, you can help us out all the same. You can help us to find out who it is, and you will, won't you? Because, as it's not you, you can't in the least mind what I've been saying." Margaret, freeing her arm from her visitor's hold, drew back a step, but Lady Caroline instantly rejoined her. "Of course, I can see that. If it had been, you might have been annoyed. I dare say I put the case stupidly, but I'm so bewildered by this new development, by his using you all this time as a pretext, that I really don't know where to turn for light on the mystery." She had Margaret in her imperious grasp again, but the latter broke from her with a more resolute gesture. "I'm afraid I have no light to give you," she began, but once more Lady Caroline caught her up. "Oh, but do please understand me. I condemn Guy most strongly for using your name, when we all know you'd been so amazingly kind to him. I haven't a word to say in his defense, but of course the important thing now is, who is the woman, sincere or not?" The question rang out loudly, as if all the pale Puritan corners of the room flung it back with a shudder at the speaker. In the silence that ensued, Margaret felt the blood ebbing back to her heart. Then she said, in a distinct and level voice, "I know nothing of the history of Mr. Dawnish." Lady Caroline gave a stare and a gasp. Her distracted hand groped for her boa and she began to wind it mechanically about her long neck. "It would really be an enormous help to us, and to poor Gwendolyn Matcher," she persisted pleadingly. "And you'd be doing Guy himself a good turn." Margaret remained silent and motionless while her visitor drew on one of the worn gloves she had pulled off to adjust her veil. Lady Caroline gave the veil a final twitch. "I've come a tremendously long way," she said, "and, since it isn't you, I can't think why you won't help me." When the door had closed on her visitor, Margaret Ransom went slowly up the stairs to her room. As she dragged her feet from one step to another, she remembered how she had sprung up the same steep flight after that visit of Guy Dawnish's, when she had looked in the glass, and seen on her face the blush of youth. When she reached her room, she bolted the door as she had done that day, and again looked at herself in the narrow mirror above her dressing table. It was just a year since then the elms were budding again, the willows hanging their green veil above the bench by the river. But there was no trace of youth left in her face. She saw it now as others had doubtless always seen it. If it seemed as it did to Lady Caroline Duckett, what look must it have worn to the fresh gaze of young Guy Dawnish? A pretext, as he had been a pretext. He had used her name to screen someone else, or perhaps, merely to escape from a situation of which he was weary. She did not care to conjecture what his motive had been. Everything connected with him had grown so remote and alien. She felt no anger, only an unspeakable sadness, a sadness which she knew would never be appeased. She looked at herself long and steadily. She wished to clear her eyes of all illusions. Then she turned away and took her usual seat beside her work table. From where she sat, she could look down the empty elm-shaded street, up which, at this hour every day, she was sure to see her husband's figure advancing. She would see it presently, she would see it for many years to come. She had a sudden aching sense of the length of the years that stretched before her. Strange that one who was not young should still, in all likelihood, have so long to live. Nothing was changed in the setting of her life. Perhaps nothing would ever change in it. She would certainly live and die in Wentworth. And meanwhile the days would go on as usual, bringing the usual obligations. As the word flitted through her brain, she remembered that she had still to put the finishing touches to the paper she was to read the next afternoon at the meeting of the Higher Thought Club. The book as he had been reading lay face downward beside her, whereas he had left it an hour ago. She took it up, and slowly and painfully, like a child laboriously spelling out the syllables, she went on with the rest of the sentence. Indeed, a spring from a level not much above that of the springing of the transverse and diagonal ribs, which are so arranged as to give a convex curve to the surface of the vaulting conoid. The verdict. I had always thought Jack Gisburn rather a cheap genius, though a good fellow enough, so it was no great surprise to me to hear that, in the height of his glory, he had dropped his painting, married a rich widow, and established himself in a villa on the Riviera. Though I rather thought it would have been Rome or Florence. The height of his glory, that was what the women called it. I can hear Mrs. Gideon Thwing, his last Chicago sitter, deploring his unaccountable abdication. Oh, of course it's going to send the value of my picture way up, but I don't think of that. Mr. Rickham, the lost heir, is all I think of. The word, on Mrs. Thwing's lips, multiplied its RS, as though they were reflected in an endless vista of mirrors. And it was not only the Mrs. Thwings who mourned. Had not the exquisite Hermia Croft, at the last Grafton Gallery show, stopped me before Gisburn's own dancers to say, with tears in her eyes, "We shall not look upon its like again?" Well, even through the prism of Hermia's tears I felt able to face the fact with equanimity. Poor Jack Gisburn. The women had made him, it was fitting, that they should mourn him. Among his own sex fewer regrets were heard, and in his own trade hardly a murmur. Professional jealousy? Perhaps. If it were, the honor of the craft was vindicated by little Claude Nutley, who, in all good faith, brought out in the Burlington a very handsome obituary on Jack, one of those showy articles stocked with random technicalities that I have heard, I won't say by whom, compared to Gisburn's painting. And so his resolve being apparently irrevocable, the discussion gradually died out, and, as Mrs. Thwing had predicted, the price of Gisburn's went up. It was not till 3 years later that, in the course of a few weeks idling on the Riviera, it suddenly occurred to me to wonder why Gisburn had given up his painting. On reflection, it really was a tempting problem. To accuse his wife would have been too easy. His fair sitters had been denied the solace of saying that Mrs. Gisburn had dragged him down. For Mrs. Gisburn as such had not existed till nearly a year after Jack's resolve had been taken. It might be that he had married her, since he liked his ease, because he didn't want to go on painting. But it would have been hard to prove that he had given up his painting because he had married her. Of course, if S. he had not dragged him down, S. he had equally, as Miss Croft contended, failed to lift him up. S. he had not led him back to the easel. To put the brush into his hand again, what a vocation for a wife. But Mrs. Gisburn appeared to have disdained it, and I felt it might be interesting to find out why. The desultory life of the Riviera lends itself to such purely academic speculations. And having, on my way to Monte Carlo, caught a glimpse of Jack's balustraded terraces between the pines, I had myself borne thither the next day. I found the couple at tea beneath their palm trees, and Mrs. Gisburn's welcome was so genial that, in the ensuing weeks, I claimed it frequently. It was not that my hostess was interesting. On that point I could have given Miss Croft the fullest reassurance. It was just because she was not interesting, if I may be pardoned the bull, that I found her so. For Jack, all his life, had been surrounded by interesting women. They had fostered his art, it had been reared in the hothouse of their adulation. And it was therefore instructive to note what effect the evening atmosphere of mediocrity, I quote Miss Croft, was having on him. I have mentioned that Mrs. Gisburn was rich. And it was immediately perceptible that her husband, Anne, was extracting from this circumstance a delicate but substantial satisfaction. It is, as a rule, the people who scorn money who get most out of it, and Jack's elegant disdain of his wife's big balance enabled him, with an appearance of perfect good breeding, to transmute it into objects of art and luxury. To the latter, I must add, He remained relatively indifferent, but he was buying Renaissance bronzes and 18th century pictures with a discrimination that bespoke the amplest resources. Money's only excuses to put beauty into circulation was one of the axioms he laid down across the severs and silver of an exquisitely appointed luncheon table when, on a later day, I had again run over from Monte Carlo, and Mrs. Gisburn, beaming on him, added for my enlightenment, Jack is so morbidly sensitive to every form of beauty. Poor Jack! It had always been his fate to have women say such things of him. The fact should be set down in extenuation. What struck me now was that, for the first time, he resented the tone. I had seen him, so often, basking under similar tributes. Was it the conjugal note that robbed them of their savor? No, for, oddly enough, it became apparent that he was fond of Mrs. Gisburn, fond enough not to see her absurdity. It was his own absurdity he seemed to be wincing under, his own attitude as an object for garlands and incense. My dear, since I've chucked painting, people don't say that stuff about me, they say it about Victor Grindle, was his only protest, as he rose from the table and strolled out onto the sunlit terrace. I glanced after him, struck by his last word. Victor Grindle was, in fact, becoming the man of the moment, as Jack himself, one might put it, had been the man of the hour. The younger artist was said to have formed himself at my friend's feet, and I wondered if a tinge of jealousy underlay the latter's mysterious abdication. But no, for it was not till after that event that the Rose Dewberry drawing rooms had begun to display their Grindles. I turned to Mrs. Gisburn, who had lingered to give a lump of sugar to her spaniel in the dining room. Why has he chucked painting? I asked abruptly. She raised her eyebrows with a hint of good-humored surprise. Oh, he doesn't have to now, you know, and I want him to enjoy himself, she said quite simply. I looked about the spacious white-paneled room, with its familvert vases repeating the tones of the pale damask curtains, and its 18th-century pastels in delicate faded frames. Has he chucked his pictures too? I haven't seen a single one in the house. A slight shade of constraint crossed Mrs. Gisburn's open countenance. It's his ridiculous modesty, you know. He says they're not fit to have about. He sent them all away except one, my portrait, and that I have to keep upstairs. His ridiculous modesty, Jack's modesty about his pictures? My curiosity was growing like a beanstalk. I said persuasively to my hostess, I must really see your portrait, you know. She glanced out almost timorously at the terrace where her husband, lounging in a hooded chair, had lit a cigar and drawn the Russian deerhound's head between his knees. Well, come while he's not looking, she said, with a laugh that tried to hide her nervousness, and I followed her between the marble emperors of the hall and up the white stairs with terracotta nymphs poised among flowers at each landing. In the dimmest corner of her boudoir, amid a profusion of delicate and distinguished objects, hung one of the familiar oval canvases, in the inevitable garlanded frame. The mere outline of the frame called up all Gisburn's past. Mrs. Gisburn drew back the window curtains, moved aside a jardiniere full of pink azaleas, pushed an armchair away, and said, if you stand here you can just manage to see it. I had it over the mantelpiece, but he wouldn't let it stay. Yes, I could just manage to see it, the first portrait of Jack's I had ever had to strain my eyes over. Usually they had the place of honor, say the central panel in a pale yellow or rose dewberry drawing room, or a monumental easel placed so that it took the light through curtains of old Venetian point. The more modest place became the picture better. Yet, as my eyes grew accustomed to the half-light, all the characteristic qualities came out, all the hesitations disguised as audacities, the tricks of prestidigitation by which, with such consummate skill, he managed to divert attention from the real business of the picture to some pretty irrelevance of detail. Mrs. Gisburn, presenting a neutral surface to work on forming, as it were, so inevitably the background of her own picture had lent herself in an unusual degree to the display of this false virtuosity. The picture was one of Jack's strongest, as his admirers would have put it. It represented, on his part, a swelling of muscles, a congesting of veins, a balancing, straddling, and straining, that reminded one of the circus clown's ironic efforts to lift a feather. It met, in short, at every point the demand of lovely woman to be painted strongly, because she was tired of being painted weakly, and yet not to lose an atom of the sweetness. "It's the last he painted, you know," Mrs. Gisburn said with pardonable pride. "Tea the last but one," she corrected herself, "but the other doesn't count, because he destroyed it." "Destroyed it?" I was about to follow up this clue, when I heard a footstep and saw Jack himself on the threshold. As he stood there, his hands in the pockets of his velveteen coat, the thin brown waves of hair pushed back from his white forehead, his lean sunburned cheeks furrowed by a smile that lifted the tips of a self-confident mustache, I felt to what a degree he had the same quality as his pictures, the quality of looking cleverer than he was. His wife glanced at him deprecatingly, but his eyes traveled past her to the portrait. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.